Is it possible that scientists are understating the seriousness of the climate change dilemma? Could positive reinforcing feedback loops lead to the extinction of the human species by 2030? Is geoengineering an option? Can anything be done to prevent not only the end of humanity, but life on Earth as well? Should anything be done? On a special installment of the Global Research NewsHour, a feature-length interview with the prominent social critic, conservation biologist, and paradigm-shifting author and speaker, Guy McPherson. On today's program, Near-Term Human Extinction, a conversation with Guy McPherson. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 7th, 2014. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Why is EU Foreign Minister Catherine Ashton protecting and covering up for the Maidan Square snipers who killed both demonstrators and police? Ashton knew, at least since February 25th, but most likely much, much longer, when she was told directly by the Estonia Foreign Minister, Urmas Paet, quote, "There is now stronger and stronger understanding that behind the snipers it was not Yanukovych, but it was somebody from the new coalition," unquote. Paet's source is one of the most prominent medical authorities in Ukraine, Olga Bogomolets, who just refused to be appointed deputy prime minister of the new government, despite pressures from Ashton herself. Quote, "What was quite disturbing, the same Olga told as well that all the evidence shows that the people who were killed by snipers from both sides, among policemen and then people from the streets, that they were the same snipers killing people from both sides, so that she then also showed me some photos. She said that as a medical doctor, she can say that it is the same handwriting, the same type of bullets, and it's really disturbing that now the new coalition, that they don't want to investigate what exactly happened," unquote. It is not clear if Dr. Olga Bogomolets, who comes from a distinguished family of medical professionals that dates back to the 15th century, refused to accept a position in the new government because of what she had seen. However, it is Ashton herself who recognized that it's not possible to push aside her professional competence and actually stressed that she told Dr. Bogomolets that she should be part of the government, possibly as Minister of Health. That is from the article, "The Big Lie of Ukraine's Maidan Revolution, The Organizers of the Coup d'Etat Hired the Snipers," by Umberto Pascali, posted March 5th. Racists from across Europe have traveled to Kiev. Wearing these symbols on their helmets and jackets, these thugs roamed Kiev and defaced the homes of Jews. They destroyed memorials to those who fought the Nazi invasion and occupation of the Ukraine in World War II. Offices of the Communist Party of the Ukraine were ransacked and destroyed, revolutionary books publicly burned in bonfires. Amidst this offensive fascist vandalism, progressive people have mobilized to protect progressive centers, monuments, and government buildings. That's from the article, "Why Are Nazi and Confederate Flags on Display in Kiev?" by Sarah Flounders, posted March 5th, originally appearing at workers.org. There is a reason why Russian President Vladimir Putin cited ultra-nationalists as one of the reasons why Russian troops had to intervene in Ukraine. What we are seeing in Ukraine right now is eerily reminiscent of what we saw in Nazi Germany before World War II. The following comes from a recent Gawker article. Quote, "Earlier this week, a synagogue in the country's southeast was firebombed. A leading rabbi in Kiev has called for Jews to leave the city and the country if possible, though he later said he was stressing that it's dangerous for everyone out there, and the Israeli embassy has reportedly advised members of the Jewish community to stay off the streets." That is from the article, "Why is the mainstream media ignoring the rabid anti-Semitism of the new Ukraine government?" by Michael Snyder, posted March 5th, originally appearing at The Truth. The ADL doesn't address the fact that former Israeli soldiers fought alongside with known neo-Nazi militants who now claim to reject anti-Semitism. It is worth noting that the U.S. media, as well as the ADL, refrain from using the terms neo-Nazi, neo-fascist, and extremist. Instead of condemning this abnormal alliance, the ADL sees a glimmer of hope in the promises of Right Sector and Spilna Sprava, groups which the Israeli media itself qualified as fascist and neo-Nazi. Israel's Haaretz also reported that members of Svoboda and Pravi Sektor were flying flags with neo-Nazi symbols and were distributing freshly translated editions of Mein Kampf and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion in Independence Square. The Anti-Defamation League should not only firmly condemn the presence of all the fascist and neo-Nazi groups in the post-coup Ukrainian government, but also denounce the countries which support them morally and or financially, like the U.S., Canada, and member countries of the European Union. That is from the article, "Democratization and Anti-Semitism in Ukraine, When Neo-Nazi Symbols Become the New Normal," by Julie Levesque, posted March 6th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Climate change has been recognized by leading scientists as one of the greatest threats to the welfare of the human species. The message percolating down to the masses is that our society must act to prevent catastrophe. Unfortunately, it is too late to do anything to stop the destruction put into motion decades ago. So says the subject of today's conversation. Guy McPherson is Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. He is also the author of the blog Nature Bats Last and author of several books, including his most recent, Going Dark. While Dr. McPherson does not question the science of human-generated climate change, his approach of accepting the inevitable has rubbed some environmentalists the wrong way. He maintains that between human society's carbon addiction, the threat from hundreds of nuclear reactors going critical, and other factors, humanity's fate is pretty much sealed. Yet, he seems to see something positive in this gloomy prognosis. Dr. McPherson traveled to Winnipeg, Canada near the beginning of February 2014 for a rare Canadian speaking engagement. I had a chance to hear the talk and later interview him in person at the CKUW studio. Over the course of the hour, we discussed his ideas and the best way to react to the dim outlook for humanity's future.
Really, what I'm trying to do is summarize and synthesize and integrate the scientific information. And the reason I do that is because I don't see anybody else doing it. I see people in their academic silos, and I spent a long time there myself, so I understand. People in their academic silos studying a small part of a big story, working on a piece of a puzzle and losing sight of the big picture that is the puzzle. And so I'm trying to bring the big picture together. The science indicates that we've never had humans on a planet 3.5 degrees warmer than baseline, meaning at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So we'll say the baseline temperature from 1750 or so, or even 1850, because it's essentially the same. And since that time, global average temperature has risen 0.85 degrees centigrade. We haven't had humans on the planet at 3.5 degrees above baseline. And it looks like we're headed there in the near term. We have triggered some 30 self-reinforcing feedback loops on the climate front. A detailed assessment of one of those, the one we've known about in the scientific literature the longest, methane released from the Arctic Ocean, indicates that we'll be well above 3.5 degrees by 2030, and in the neighborhood of 10 degrees or more above baseline by 2040. And I just don't see any way for humans to survive those kind of global average temperatures. Not because we aren't incredibly adaptable, right? I mean, I came from outside in Winnipeg today, and I'm from the American Southwest, so this is a shock to my system. Not because we can't handle those kind of changes in temperature in a relatively short period of time. We do it every day when we walk indoors and go outdoors. But because there just won't be habitat for humans on the planet at those kind of temperatures. We won't have the ability to grow food. We won't have the ability to extract and deliver water. In many places of the globe, we will have wet bulb temperatures above 35 degrees centigrade. And humans can't survive those temperatures, even with a fan on them and cold water pouring down on them. They cannot survive 6 hours at that kind of wet bulb temperature. So there's all kinds of reasons that point towards our near-term demise. It's a horrific conclusion to reach, and I understand why a lot of people don't want to spend their time contemplating it, or maybe can't even go there from an emotional or intellectual perspective.
Hmm. Well, it's you talk about academics and their silos, and it's compelling to wonder if there aren't some sort of institutional obstacles to getting at it. I mean, a lot of research being financed by corporate entities and foundations and whatnot. Do you see those sorts of obstacles, or is it mostly a psychological barrier? Do you have any thoughts about that?
It's all of the above. I spent 20 years at the University of Arizona, and I was also employed by or spent time at various other universities, from small liberal arts college in the American Midwest to the big time, you know, to Cal Berkeley. The University of Arizona is a big Research One institution. And there's a variety of factors that play into why academics won't go to the extremes that people think I've gone to in connecting some dots. One is the academic silos. The nature of the institutions is to encourage people to learn more and more about less and less until it isn't long before you know everything about nothing at all. Mm-hmm. And so that's the culture. And the culture is also to focus on civilization, not on habitat for humans, but on civilization itself. And it's one of those things that we accept as a given, that civilization is good. This set of living arrangements, industrial civilization, is the best we can do. And so with our every assumption, with our every statement, we imply that civilized life is the only life to lead, despite considerable evidence to the contrary. And growth is good. Of course, that's all we've ever heard in our entire lives, is growth is good, and the growth of civilization is therefore good for more people. There's also explicit, overt institutional barriers in many cases. People are actively discouraged from working on various topics. Universities have become mere microcosms of the greater culture. And the greater culture is corporate. We have a corporate government, we have corporate media, we have corporate universities. Who funds them? Corporations. At most major research universities now, a very, very small proportion of their budget comes from directly from taxpayers. somewhere between 25 and 30%. Mm-hmm. Well, that means 70% or so is coming from elsewhere. Where is that elsewhere? It's granting agencies, it's corporations, it's Monsanto feeding into the colleges of agriculture and life sciences. It's Nike. So a classic example, when I left the University of Arizona, university faculty and staff were not allowed to display a corporate logo when they were on official business. So I couldn't go into my classroom mm-hmm. with an Adidas shirt, for example, or a cap from the local seed company on a field trip. None of that was allowed because it would give the impression that I was somehow supporting this organization, right? Mm. On the other hand, whereas no faculty or staff, while they're engaged in official duty, can display a corporate logo, every athlete, every headshot of every athlete at the University of Arizona was required to have the Nike swoosh stripe in it. This is a classic, classic example of priorities run amok. You could argue that Nike exerts considerable influence over that institution, and I think that argument would be well made, in fact. So it's corporate culture. It's civilized corporate culture. And if you don't go along with that, you're a pariah. You're the person who can't get along with the institution, with the administrators of the institution. And so there are some overt actions that have been taken that, for example, I was subject to. The first administrative act of my last department head was to ban me from teaching in my home department. I was asking students to question the dominant paradigm. Mm-hmm. You don't do that when you're embedded within the dominant paradigm.
Yeah, and the paradigm can include both the left and right being sort of the same idea. I mean, I could see where you're getting as much criticism from the environmental activist community who believe that you're just sort of sabotaging any attempt to do something to protect us from this onslaught of Armageddon.
Yes, in a single interview from a couple of years ago, the comments on that interview compared me unfavorably to Al Gore, and a subsequent comment compared me unfavorably to Rush Limbaugh. Most people would conclude that those two guys are pretty far apart on the political spectrum. Yes, I catch heat from both, quote, sides, but it's really one side. It's the side of the corporate entities running the world at this point, the civilized world at this point, and certainly running the government and the media mm-hmm. in the United States. So the two prevailing political parties in the United States, the Democratic and Republican parties, are really just two mouthpieces for corporations. Yeah. And I don't see a significant difference between those two so-called separate parties, two separate entities. We are a culture of growth. We're a culture of growth at all costs. And
it's our God.
Yeah, greed is our only God, as nearly as I can tell.
Hmm. I wonder if we could just go back to examining the raw scientific data and trying our best to eliminate those sorts of filters. I think for a lot of people, like in the wider audience, the non-academic community, there's some confusion as to, they're clearly seeing a climate change, but they're easily dissuaded from the idea that carbon has been the main driver, that this is not a cyclical phenomenon, that, maybe next decade we'll have a cooling spell. We've got open water at the North Pole, glaciers all over the place melting. I think empirically that's pretty well documented. But the question being, how can we be assured that, carbon is the main driver and that there aren't other activities going on that may be adding to the mix and that this isn't something that might be reversed through some natural mechanism? Is that something you can address?
Sure. And it's easy to understand why most people are confused, because there's a $1 billion industry focused on denial.
Or at least obfuscation.
Yes. And so it's analogous to the cigarette companies putting out propaganda 50 or 60 years ago about smoking being good for you. Not only not bad for you, but actually being good for you, years after the science was conclusive that the opposite was true. And so now we have this billion-dollar a year industry just in the United States that focuses on obscuring what's really happening. And, you know, if you're not a scientist, and most people aren't, and you depend upon the media for the information, and most people do, well, there's a problem. Because the media are dominated by a very few corporations, by a handful of corporations. They're all about growth. They're all about economic growth. And there's no money in human extinction. There's no money to be made by pointing out that we're headed for our own demise. So it's easy to understand why people, for the most part, haven't even heard that notion, much less taking it in with open arms. But let's look at a few of the scientific facts. We've never had humans on a planet at 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, ever. We've never had human beings on a planet with 350 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's the goal of 350.org. It's a death sentence, of course, for many people in small island nations. We until quite recently, had never had human beings on a planet more than 300 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Now we're at 400. When humans spent the first 2 million years on the planet, we had, on average, less than 700 parts per billion of methane. We're now well over 2,000 parts per billion methane.
Methane is about 100 times more potent a greenhouse gas
than carbon dioxide in the short term. That's right. And projected out over a century is still about 20 times more powerful, molecule for molecule, than carbon dioxide is. So it's an unbelievably powerful warming element. And so it doesn't take a lot of methane in the atmosphere to produce significant warming. In addition, we also know that there's a lag between emissions and consequences, between cause and effect. So the emissions from 40 years ago are what we're seeing today. The emissions we're producing today will have consequences 40 years from now. In the last 29 and a half years now, I guess, based on the timing of the journal article that reported this, in the last 29 years, we've emitted more greenhouse gases than we had in the previous 300 years combined. So given the lag in temperature rise after the emissions appear, we're headed for a serious storm on the temperature front because of those emissions that we've already locked in to the atmosphere. So there's no undoing that. There's no way at scale to reduce carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, to take that methane back out once it's in the atmosphere. So it's all there. There's a lifetime lag, a generation or so lag, and then boom, we're done.
Well, as far as the carbon is concerned, I mean, I've heard some thoughts about maybe if we just plant more vegetation, that they'd eat up all that CO2 like crazy, and thereby, you know, that could be an attempt to address that issue. But we're not aware of any similar mechanism that could eliminate methane.
Yes, that's correct. And in addition, the magnitude of the tree planting effort to temporarily extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere would be truly monumental. Talk about your war effort. Think about World War II times a million or so. Planting trees in areas that they aren't currently found. Where's the water going to come from? Where's the energy going to come from to deliver that water? And it's a temporary phenomenon. Those trees die, you know. And when they do, that carbon dioxide goes back up where it came from. Mm-hmm. And so we don't know of a technological solution or a fix that scales. There have been various geoengineering proposals that have been launched, but the journal literature is increasingly clear on this point that they won't work. They can't work. We can't simply undo what we've done on the climate front by launching the techno-messiah. by some sort of technological solution to undo what we've done. People have looked at several of those solutions.
How long have they
detail.
Been looking at those sorts of techno fixes?
Only quite recently.
Only recently.
You know, it's only become quite recent that people have become aware that, wow, we're in very dangerous terrain here. We have let the beast out of the box, and it looks like we're threatened. Our own species is threatened. Of course, you know, we're driving 200 species a day to extinction as a result of various activities associated with industrial civilization. It's clear we don't care much about them, but now we're talking about us, right? We're talking about us, so now we're very concerned about it. But that's only been within the last few years that awareness has arisen. So it's only been within the last few years that people have contemplated how to turn this ship around.
That's the whole boiling frog scenario, where you put a frog in gradually warming up water. It won't realize that it's in trouble until it's too late. But as an evolutionary biologist, I mean, you're aware of the fact that we've had an unprecedented species extinction. And historically, whenever you have that scale of a species extinction, it's usually the dominant species that ultimately perishes.
Yes, we're in the midst of the sixth great extinction. It's happening more rapidly than any of the previous five great extinction events. And this is the only one driven by a single species.
Mm-hmm.
And that species is us. And as we drive 200 species a day to extinction, it's pretty evident that you can't keep that up for a long period of time without taking your own species into the abyss. And no matter how clever we are, and no matter what kind of technology we have developed, we need habitat just like every other organism on the planet. And if we create an environment that doesn't include habitat for ourselves, we're done. Mm. We're human animals, emphasis on the animal part. And we need those elements for survival, just like every other species. We need a certain level of oxygen. We need clean air. We need clean water. We need food to eat and so on. We need to maintain our body temperature. If we can't do that because we've created an entirely new planet, then we aren't going to survive.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I know that your much of your research and your conclusions are prefaced on this idea of self-reinforcing feedback loops. Is there any possibility of some natural mechanism that might be, countering these entities? I mean, the talk about Earth effectively being like an organism itself. Might there be some sort of a climate change antibody that we have yet to discover?
There could be, in fact. And these self-reinforcing feedback loops are sometimes called positive feedbacks, even though they don't seem very positive. They're positive in that when you kick a soccer ball on a football field, it quickly stops because the friction forces it to stop rolling. Well, what we've done with these self-reinforcing feedback loops or positive feedbacks is kick the ball over a cliff. And so the faster, the further down the hill it goes, the faster it goes. You know, it picks up speed as it's going down, and it appears to be no way to stop it. Are there negative feedbacks? Certainly. And in fact, several times through deep history, we see temperatures rise quickly and catastrophically, but then go back down again. We don't understand those particularly well. We've never had human beings burning so much carbon in such a short period of time that might, in fact, overcome those. I know of only one negative feedback that has been studied sufficiently to maybe undo some of what we've done, but it operates in a linear fashion, not an exponential fashion, and that's the release of energy from Earth. As the Earth heats, it actually releases more energy into space than it was doing before. So as the temperature rises, it releases more of that energy into space. So that's a negative feedback. That's the only one of significance I know about. There must be others, because the planet has gone through these cycles where it's warmed and then cooled again in the past, but we don't know much about them. And I suspect, given how we have pumped carbon and pumped methane into the atmosphere, that we're in all new terrain here, that we aren't, we don't understand the system well enough to know for sure, but it appears that we are that Earth is not going to overcome our hubris and our own civilization to swoop in at the last second like the movie and save us from ourselves.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. What about the argument of near-term human extinction? That seems very dire. I mean, yeah, the climate could change and it could get really, really hot. But, surely maybe there could be a sizable chunk of humanity that dies. But, I mean, we can't even save a few hundred, maybe gather together some of the food somehow, maybe put up some sort of a little biosphere. How could you be so confident, if that's the word for it, that we are, that the last human being will be gone by the middle of the 21st century?
Well, again, it's because of habitat, or specifically loss of habitat. Can we build a bunker that will support a few people and get us through to some better stage? Well, let's talk about what needs to go into that. Into that bunker must go enough food and water to persist for a long time. Because remember, the emissions we're producing today are going to manifest themselves in 40 years. So we need to make it how long? How long do we need to make it in that bunker? 100 years? 200 years? 2,000 years? We don't know. Humans, particularly civilized humans, have a propensity to go into overshoot. And that's where we are. We have, clearly exceeded the carrying capacity for humans on the planet. So we need to overcome that behavior in the bunker, right? So we need to produce just enough humans to replace ourselves. So somehow we need to overcome this, what I think is probably a built-in evolutionary propensity for replicating ourselves to the point of overshoot. We need to overcome that for these people in the bunker. For some period of time, we need to have the ability to produce air, food, and water in the right temperature in this bunker for a very long period of time. Again, most people don't understand the exponential function, and it appears that methane has gone exponential. It appears that we fired the clathrate gun, or the hydrate gun. That's the little cages that hold the methane in the Arctic. It appears we fired the clathrate gun in 2007, so about 7 years ago. An analysis of just that single feedback indicates we are, as a planet, going to experience temperatures similar to Venus by the end of this century.
Yeah.
How are we going to overcome that? At what point do we come out of the bunker to a dead planet with essentially no life on it at all? Mm-hmm. And survive as a species. There's recent research from the astrophysical world. Astrophysicists for years believed that Earth was right in the middle of the habitable zone. Given the size of our sun and the distance from that sun, there's a relatively narrow band in which life as we know it can persist. And astrophysicists thought for a long time we were right in the middle of that habitable zone, right in the middle of the band. Research from just last year, 2013, indicates that we're at the very inner edge of the habitable zone, within 1% of being out of the habitable zone. What that indicates is that we make minor changes to our atmosphere, and we can push ourselves out of that habitable zone, and we can go Venus. We've made major changes to our atmosphere. We haven't made minor changes to our atmosphere. We've made major changes to our atmosphere. And it seems that we've pushed ourselves out of that habitable zone. I don't care how long you stay in the bunker, unless it's millions and millions of years, we're in trouble.
Okay. What about science fiction scenarios, colonizing Mars? He asked in desperation.
Well, this is a Stephen B. Hawking approach. In fact, he has suggested we do just that. Well, there's all kinds of responses to that. One, I don't think we have the cheap energy necessary to launch that kind of program anymore.
That's the other side of the carbon coin.
Right. The other side of the fossil fuel coin is that we passed the peak in net energy. And so we're on the downhill side. It gets really expensive to send people to Mars. Also, there's the Ray Bradbury novel, The Martian Chronicles, pointing out, given civilized human behavior, just what happens under those kinds of conditions. And in the novel, as you might recall, humans from Earth populated Mars as an escape strategy and witnessed from Mars the explosion of planet Earth as we killed ourselves on planet Earth. And by that point, it was already well underway on Mars. So we have to change human behavior in addition to making this technological change or this techno fix. And can we change human behavior, civilized human behavior? I haven't seen much evidence of that. In addition, there's the philosophical, maybe even existential question. Do we deserve that? Is there a better planet than this? Are we going to find a better planet than this? I mean, look at what we had here and that we destroyed and continue to destroy every day. We continue to foul the air and dirty the water and pollute every aspect of the planet while driving other species to extinction. And we're looking for a way out because we couldn't keep our affairs in order here? I'm not sure that's a reasonable expectation. After I speak, people come up to me very frequently and ask one of two questions. What about aliens? Don't you think there are aliens out there and they're going to save us? And my response always is, okay, pretend I'm an alien and you tell me, you convince me that you're worth saving. And then there's the religious response. And there was this poor woman trapped beside me on an airplane a few months ago. And she was in the window seat and I was in the aisle seat, poor woman. And she started promoting her religious beliefs. And so I started talking to her about near-term human extinction as a result of climate change. And she said, I just can't believe that God would allow that to happen to us. And I said, okay, so do you think he's pretty impressed with what we've done with the place so far? I mean, if really we are here to steward the earth, can you imagine a worse job? We were supposed to steward the planet and take care of things. Instead, we're driving 200 species a day to extinction and destroying all the habitat we need to survive. If I were in his shoes, I wouldn't be impressed.
God's saying, okay, let's scrap this project. Let's start over. but even I don't even think you have to be necessarily religious. It seems to me that there's that sort of psychology that might encompass certain atheists. They just can't believe that that this is an insoluble prospect.
David Ehrenfeld, the conservation biologist, wrote a book many, many years ago, 40 probably at this point, called The Arrogance of Humanism. And that's where secular humanism goes, is that humans are actually special. That just like religious acolytes, they conclude that the planetary environment is here for us. I don't see a big difference between the secular approach and the religious approach from that perspective, in that maybe it's not all here for us. Maybe we're an evolutionary outcome based on a series of accidents that Stephen Jay Gould wrote in his book, A Wonderful Life. And we just happened to land here, and now we have all this power, and we really haven't figured out how to control it. And so we've launched this experiment. With respect to those self-reinforcing feedback loops, you know, we don't know they exist until after we've triggered them. So that's one of the great dangers here, and that is connected to human behavior. Okay. We recognize the emergency only when the building burned down. So that's a little late to send the firefighters in.
Yeah, that's the runaway brain. You know, like other organisms, maybe because of their built-in mechanisms, mortality, they've managed to avoid, you know, tripping any of these tipping points that would put the planet in chaos. But we have this extra little package in our cerebral cortex that allows us to defy nature ultimately to our own doom.
Yes. And so, you know, Homo sapiens, sapiens means wise, we're the wise apes. And I think that's something of a poor name. I think we're very clever. We're clever enough to modify the habitat around us. To come up with incredible technology, starting with clothing and fire, that allows us to persist in areas that other organisms wouldn't be able to make those adaptations. You know, so we're incredibly clever, but I'm not sure we're all that wise. We have populated the planet every corner of the planet and modified the planet so that we can occupy those areas. And it's all full now, and it's beyond full at this point. So now what becomes the relevant question?
Well, I think I want to resurrect a question from last night, because I think it's a very compelling one, and that's the whole issue of the 1% or you know, the elites within the 1%, the 1% of the 1%, because it seems to me they would make it their business to know the truth, you know, whether it's pleasant or not. I mean, what they say to the public, that's a whole other issue, but what they discuss among themselves in terms of protecting their own legacies, their own lives, they must have confronted what you're putting, what your diagnosis. How do you see them addressing this whole dilemma? What are they doing? What can they do? What would they most likely be doing in order to address the situation? Are they looking to preserve their existence, or are they sort of embracing this you know, existential, well, look on the bright side of life element? How are they responding? Do you have any read on that?
A little bit. Of course, my take is quite limited because I'm not a member of the 1%.
You're not privy to those conversations.
And I'm not the fly on the wall.
Thanks for your report, Dr. McPherson. Go away.
But I suspect they are human beings, just like the rest of us. And so there's probably a continuum of responses that they've developed. They are the 1% in large part because they're psychopaths. So they do things that you and I would never do, if that includes backstabbing and hurting, maiming, killing people along their way to riches. That's okay, and they continue to get away with this because those of us who are not psychopaths would never think of that.
So they see this as an opportunity to make money.
Yes. Make more money as the world burns. It's always worked for them so far. In addition, I suspect some of them are counting on the techno messiah to come save them, because she always has before. I suspect many of them are planning. In fact, I know many of them are planning for a future that includes them for as long as possible. So by moving to the Southern Hemisphere, where there will be habitat for humans longer than there will be in the Northern Hemisphere. So I think there's a wide range of responses, from we're going to keep doing what we've been doing so far that got us to this point, that got us our riches, until we can't. And again, we only see those self-reinforcing feedback loops in the rearview mirror. So they maybe didn't know what was coming until it was too late to do anything about it. And then it was too late to do anything about it, except buy property in South America and start developing that property so they can live out their days, or maybe the days of their children, in relative comfort.
Southern Hemisphere being a little bit more habitable in the near term.
Right, because it's so strongly dominated by water relative to land, for one thing. And also because the nuclear power plants
are scarce. Yeah, we haven't even gotten into the nuclear part yet.
Exactly.
Fukushima, yeah.
Right, so there are very, very few nuclear power plants in the Southern Hemisphere, and prevailing winds, general circulation dynamics of the globe will protect especially the southern portions of the Southern Hemisphere for far longer than places like the interior of a large continent in the Northern Hemisphere. You know, the interior portion of large continents, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, warms up more than twice as fast as the global average. So when we hit 2 for global average, 2 degrees, we're probably looking at 5 for the interior of large continents. Where I live, the southwestern interior of large continent, Northern Hemisphere, that's the most rapid place to observe warming. So that's the place we're going to lose habitat for humans fastest. So I suspect a bunch of the members of the 1% are moving away from the interior of large continents, if they're young enough to make those changes and look forward to a few more years on the planet. Mm-hmm. Others aren't. Others are staying where they are. I suspect some are fully adopting the suggestions I make and living as if we're in hospice, living with compassion and with care for humans and other organisms in their final years. And, I mean, these are people who've had a good run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've had the comforts of civilized life. And so maybe some of those people are concluding that it has been a wonderful life, and they're going to go out with some dignity and grace.
Yeah. And take every other species on the planet with them.
That's one of the artifacts that we didn't know about for a long time. You know, that that growing the industrial economy has consequences. And a lot of people still don't know that, still aren't aware of that, and are unconcerned when they find out.
Mm-hmm.
Because what has a little beetle done for me lately?
Of course, we are familiar with our political leaders' responses to these, or non-responses to these facts. These leaders committed to the infinite growth paradigm are going to places like Copenhagen and these climate summits and talking about, you know, renewable energy and how we're going to cut the emissions by such and such by the year such and such, and. I mean, even with the Kyoto Protocol, even Rio, if I'm hearing you correctly, those proposals, those meetings were coming 20 years too late to do anything about the current situation.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And in addition, there's never been any implementation of the very modest agreements that were reached at those big meetings. So it was too late. It was too little. And as a consequence, we keep putting the pedal to the metal on a runaway train.
Mm-hmm. So what is the appropriate, for politically oriented citizens, we won't say politicians, but what is the responsible approach to once faced with confronting these facts? What is the responsible use of our remaining resources and time? What should we be doing?
Well, the very word resource raises my ire because it assumes that everything on this planet is for us, it's for humans. So when I hear the word resource, I think of the word relation. Now, I would like us to live in relationship to other organisms, not treat other organisms as resources.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gone so far, in fact, that we treat other human beings as resources. In my lifetime, we have gone from every corporation and every institution having personnel departments to having departments of human resources. We're all cogs in the wheel at this point for the corporations that rule the world, whether it's corporate government, corporate media, and now corporate universities. It's the corporations who are benefiting, and by the corporations who are benefiting, I mean the relatively few within the highest echelons of those corporations who are financially benefiting from the set of living arrangements. So what do we do? What do we do from a political perspective? I don't see any change. I don't see, even if the people rise up and try to conquer the corporate leaders in the society, I don't see the corporate leaders ever changing. And I don't actually see a lot of interest in having them do that. I don't know 20 people on the planet who think that terminating the set of living arrangements is a good idea. Never mind that it's taken us to the abyss, that it drives several hundred species to extinction. Never mind that it fouls the air and pollutes the water and all those other untoward elements that are consequences of industrial civilization. I still don't see very many people suggesting we stop. Hmm. We stop economic growth. No, that's anathema. And it's certainly political anathema. Nobody's going to be elected or reelected if they propose shutting down industrial civilization just because it's going to save a couple hundred species today and every day, just because it's going to allow us to clean our act. No, everybody I know is far more interested in smartphones than they are in clean water. Mm-hmm. So I don't see any big push coming along. As far as individuals, how do we take in and deal with this information and live with some element of grace and dignity and respect for ourselves? Well, that's personal.
Hmm. I want to resurrect a line from your talk. You said, given the current situation, we're damned if we do, and we're damned if we don't. So do.
Yes.
You want to explain that imperative?
Yes. It seems to me that no matter what we do as individuals, we're headed for the abyss. But that's always been true. I've known since I was 11 years old I was going to die, that birth was lethal. Nobody gets out alive. I suspect most other people have reached the same conclusion at a similar age. That in fact, we're going to die. That no matter what we do, we're going to die. And that our years on this planet are relatively few regardless. Even if you live to be 80 or 100 years old, I suspect people who live to be 80 or 100 years old, when they look back in their final days, it's a few memories. It's the blink of an eye. So we have these relatively few moments that we remember. And we remember moments. We don't remember whole days. Right? We don't remember whole hours in a row, even. We remember moments. So let's create those moments. If you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, then let's create moments by doing things that make the world a better place so that we can look back at the end of our lives and we can retreat into ourselves and contemplate what we've done and leave the planet with a little shred of respect for ourselves. Mm. Because we acted with compassion and kindness towards humans and other animals, that we actually left more wood on the stack than when we came in. That we treated our planetary citizens, human and otherwise, with the kind of respect we hope people treat us.
Yeah, I think that like you're basically making that comparison between the life of a single individual and the life of a species, mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people deal with the mortality question by saying that we'll live on through our offspring, through our works. And in this instance, there's no living on. I mean, we are really facing a mortality with a capital M.
Yes, and that's different. You know, we're
isn't it?
We're unique in that we have a concept of a legacy, right? As individuals, we can think about our legacy, but in fact, that legacy is lost to us as soon as we die. We don't know what happens. We don't know what legacy we have left behind when we exit the planetary stage. Now what I'm talking about is no legacy at all. No human legacy for any of us. So then what? That becomes the big question. That's the ecologically literate question, according to Garrett Hardin from several decades ago. Then what? How do I live my life? And I would argue that we live our lives the same regardless. That we treat others with kindness and compassion, that we try to make the world a better place, even if the world is not going to be a better place, that we take the kinds of actions that we revere people for in retrospect, that we treat Rosa Parks as a hero for sitting where she did on the bus because she was. That we take those same kinds of actions, even at personal risk to ourselves, because they make the world a better place for humans and other organisms. Even if it's just for the day, even if it's just for the hour. Because remember, those moments are what we have. So let's live in them now. Let's live here now.
So that's where the optimism is. Knowing that our individual lives have that expiration date, it magnifies the significance of what happens in that short time frame. And now, as we're looking at the end of our species, everything that's happening from now until that final date, it magnifies the significance of us here and now as a people.
Yes. You want to exhibit some humanity? Some of the positive sides of humanity? What better time than now? For me and many other people, the message is incredibly liberating. I get to do the things that people thought were crazy. So far outside of the box that people wouldn't even consider doing them. Why? Because I'm mortal. I know I'm going to die. I don't care what culture thinks about what I'm doing. I don't have to care about that anymore because this culture's not going to be around for much longer. So I can take those risks that I've never taken before, and so can you. And those risks include kindness and compassion and wearing your heart on your sleeve and making the world better at great personal cost for humans and other animals. Yes, let's live here now as if here and now is what matters, because it is. In fact, it always has been.
Well, Dr. Guy McPherson, really enjoyed this conversation. In spite of the somewhat gloomy, at least at first glance, subject matter. I know that you've no doubt given many of the people who listen to your talk plenty of information to chew over coming months, including this interviewer. It's something that we're all going to be struggling with, and so I want to thank you for continuing with this conversation. It's a very important one for us to have. And
well,
thank you for being my guest.
Thank you, Michael. I greatly appreciate the opportunity. I'm still learning, too, and I'm still evolving as a human being and trying to find my way, just like everybody else, trying to muddle through. And having these conversations that become public allows me to contemplate issues in greater depth than I otherwise would. So thank you for the opportunity.
Professor Guy McPherson of the Emeritus Professor Guy McPherson of the University of Arizona, and he is the author of the blog Nature Bats Last, and his recent book Going Dark is now available in bookstores. That concludes our show. If you'd like to pursue Dr. McPherson's work further with updates or order a copy of his book, please visit his website, guymcpherson.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.